So welcome to EKU Podcasts. Today I'm speaking to Dr. Michael Wright. He's a GP and a research fellow at University of Technology in Sydney. He was a clinical GP in London and a research fellow at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And he's been an EKU author for the past three EKUs. And today we're going to be having a talk about chronic pain, including neuropathic pain, based on the SINE guidelines and NICE neuropathic pain guidelines. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, Tom.
Hi, good to speak to you today. So how did you find this module?
Look, I found it really interesting. I think the SINE guidelines were very helpful in that they actually tried to assimilate a lot of the evidence about managing chronic pain in adults and tried to create a few useful algorithms and a few pathways. They had a focus on neuropathic pain as well, and that also sort of combined in nicely with the NICE guidelines that came out around the same time.
And so how did you find combining the two documents for the module?
That had its difficulties, but there was a lot of similarity in the documents. There are just a few little differences that we might talk about a bit later.
Great. Can you give us a bit of a background for GPs listening about chronic pain and neuropathic pain, how common it is? And obviously, we do experience it, many patients with it in our clinical practice.
I think that's true, that we see it very frequently, and certainly the statistics that I've found suggest that nearly one in five people in Europe are currently affected by moderate to severe chronic pain, and that the prevalence is somewhere between about 6 and 8% of the population have neuropathic pain, and the large proportion of that's related to diabetes. But the chronic pain has a major effect on people's quality of life, causing a lot of suffering and large economic costs. I mean, I think the figures we've seen is that it's back pain alone is thought to cost about £12 billion annually. And then I think that even by its name, the nature of chronic pain is that often it's never able to be fully cured, and that patients need to be assessed and they need to have ongoing management. But with that, you can improve their quality of life.
How would you differentiate neuropathic pain? What do patients typically describe?
I think with all patients with chronic pain, I think you've got to take sort of a full assessment and get an idea for a history about what their pain is, how they would describe it, how it's affecting them, and how it's impacting on their day-to-day life. And I think you can develop sort of particular algorithms that will help you determine sort of what sort of pain is and what pathway you might go down.
And so what you're saying, obviously we do an individualised assessment, and as you say, pain is very subjective, so one person's pain is very different to another person. So, of course, that's where clinical assessment comes in, and also, I guess, shared decision-making with a patient.
Definitely.
It depends on how people just describe it. I mean, in the Bangladeshis where I work, it's hard when the English isn't your first language to kind of get that diagnosis. So thinking about a bit about discussing patients, once you've assessed someone, you think they have chronic pain or neuropathic pain, what sort of management would you discuss with a patient?
I think one of the things that was useful about the guidelines is it did highlight the importance of a functional assessment, and then also the number of non-pharmacological treatments that are quite useful in managing chronic pain. I think sort of firstly, one of the things we talk about a fair bit in the program is it's quite useful once you've gained your baseline assessment is like giving patients some resources to self-manage their pain, and that's important sort of as an early intervention or even as a sort of a long-term strategy. And you know, there are a lot of links to organisations like the British Pain Society, which can give patients some skills in self-management of their pain. And then also it can be useful to refer people to self-management programs, sort of more formalised programs locally. Moving on from that, sort of everyone should have that ability to have some self-management. But we talk about that there's high quality evidence for the benefit of exercise for patients with chronic pain, but that it needs to be specific advice and support given to patients. And without the support and the advice, adherence is likely to be low.
And what sort of support would that be?
Well, things like supervised exercise sessions, individualized exercises in groups, giving people written instructions, you know, rather than just saying to them, go away and exercise, actually giving them specific targeted exercises and at least some written information, or even better, some group advice to reinforce that education.
And that might be available via your local musculoskeletal physio or chronic pain service, I suppose.
Exactly, providing people with some online resources or given some written information is better than just giving them verbal advice.
Great.
There are also sort of benefits of a number of psychological support programs helping patients to understand the nature of their pain. And they could be things from as simple as sort of providing them with relaxation strategies through to more formalized cognitive behavioral therapies, even developing mindfulness skills. So by increasing patients' skill in these areas, they're going to lower their perception of their pain and hopefully help them reduce the disability they suffer.
Can you tell us a bit about any other therapies that there's no evidence for? That you cover that slightly in the module.
The couple of things we did find is there is some evidence of some manual therapies for relief in chronic low back pain and in neck pain. But this type of support is better when it's combined with exercise. There is some evidence to show that TENS, the transcutaneous nerve stimulation therapy, does improve the pain compared to placebo, but it's a little bit unclear about what works the best there. There was even some low-grade evidence suggesting that some laser therapy might have some effect on some types of pain, but there are a number of therapies that we couldn't find any high-quality evidence, including traction, homeopathy, Reiki, aromatherapy, and even music therapy.
All stuff as, I guess, alternative therapy, and there's not really good quality evidence for those at present.
So it was just interesting that the guideline did actually detail a lot of the things that there was some evidence for and things that there wasn't anything.
I guess now we move on to medications that we might suggest people take themselves over the counter or things we might prescribe. So I guess you would follow the pain ladder for that, WHO pain ladder?
Yeah, exactly. Look, you start off with some simple analgesics like regular paracetamol. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs do have evidence of benefit for patients with chronic non-specific back pain, but NSAID usage, we need to be aware of potential gastrointestinal and cardiac complications. One of the interesting drugs is that topical capsaicine has been used for peripheral neuropathic pain, which has been quite helpful. And then we might talk about neuropathic pain separately, but then sort of after that, then those medications are providing insufficient relief, then often we'll talk about opioid therapy.
Just thinking before we move on to neuropathic pain, just thinking a bit about opioids for chronic pain. Can you just give us a brief overview of some of the different opioids you might use and the evidence base or any problems with their use?
I think the opioids do tend to be differentiated into sort of your weak opioids, which are medications like tramadol or codeine, and also then your stronger drugs such as morphine, methadone, dimorphine, oxycodone, and even fentanyl. One of the analgesic ladders suggests you start with the weaker opioids first and see if you can determine what a dose, an effective dose is for a patient, and then convert them to something that may be longer acting in order to give them some regular pain relief. One of the interesting points is that some people, slow metabolizers of some of the drugs, through their cytochrome P450 system, and they may get no benefit from some of the prodrugs, such as codeine. And then there are other patients who are almost super metabolizers who get short-lived analgesia. So it's important to individually test patients to work out which of the analgesics seems to be the most effective for them.
Great. And if we move on now to neuropathic pain, and can you give us a brief overview of the guidance on that and if there's any discrepancies and really what kind of first-line agents you'd use in different scenarios?
This is probably one of the areas where there was a little bit of difference between the two guidelines. Both the SIGN guidance and the NICE guidance suggested using amitriptyline at 10 milligrams as a starting dose or gabapentin at a starting dose of 300 milligrams as the initial treatments for neuropathic pain. The NICE guidance also said you could consider duloxetine or pregabalin as other sort of potential first-line agent. But with the neuropathic pain treatments, the suggestion is to start the doses slowly, advise people to start their a particular medication low, increase it slowly until either side effects intervene or appropriate analgesia is reached. And if side effects occur, then reduce one medication and then trial another. Just because there's been failure of one doesn't mean that one of the alternative medications won't work.
And is there any kind of scenarios where you'd use one drug more than another drug? Some evidence for that? Something like duloxetine would be more considered in diabetes.
From a pure neuropathic pain, they didn't offer particular suggestions and say one is better than the other. But yeah, I do get your point that we have had some suggestion that duloxetine might be more appropriate. But then when you...
And that's in neuropathic diabetes, neuropathic pain.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you look at some of the number needed to treat information we've got, they suggest that with amitriptyline for neuropathic pain, you might have to treat 3.6 people, whereas gabapentin, it's only 2.9 for neuropathic pain, so it might be a little bit better. And then some of the duloxetine overall neuropathic numbers are a bit further out, like sort of 6 to 8, but then they're a bit more impressive for diabetic neuropathy. So I think you do need to tailor it to each patient. And as I said, just if they don't respond to one medication, it's still worth trialing another one to see if they might have a better response.
And we commonly might use amitriptyline in patients. If they got some benefit from the amitriptyline but started to have side effects, what would your options include?
Well, you can either stay at a particular dose and see if the side effects minimise, if the patient develops a little bit of tolerance. But then if the side effects do become either ongoing or unpleasant, then you reduce the dose of amitriptyline and try converting them to another medication.
Yeah.
And it is a matter of trialing the different medications to try and get the balance of adequate analgesia and side effects.
And in terms of the overall reading in the module, looking at tricyclics, it seems to be a recommendation possibly from Sign that they're not to be used for lower back pain. Is that correct? Or was there a lack of evidence for that?
Once again, it is about a lack of evidence. That the Sign guidance has been quite specific about only recommending things that does have reasonably high quality evidence.
In your clinical practice, which of these drugs would you commonly use all of them, or they tailor it to the individual patient?
I think you do tailor it. You do start off relatively weaker drugs if you can, with the paracetamol, with the anti-inflammatories, then use the neuropathic pain, the adjuvant therapies for neuropathic pain, and then introduce opioids if you need. We all have a concern about opioid dependence and issues of drug abuse, but this guidance is quite helpful in guiding you through a program to try and sort of minimise those difficulties and helping you remain more alert to problems before they become chronic.
And in which patients would you refer to a pain clinic or for some extra help?
If you feel that you're not managing the patient very well, you need to get these people back regularly for review, particularly when you're altering their medication. But if you feel that their medication needs are rapidly increasing, that just the pain control is poor, if they've got a lot of distress, and certainly if you just think that their dosage is escalating and they just don't seem to be getting any pain relief, they'd all be flags that would make you think, I think this person needs to get some specialist advice. And certainly then sort of a number that was repeatedly mentioned is that if someone's using above 180 milligrams a day of a morphine equivalent, then that's a very high dose and some specialist advice should be sought.
And so obviously this is a huge topic and we just touched the surface a bit on some of the areas. Have you found this module useful and you've implemented it in your clinical practice?
Look, I have. It's a pretty broad module, but the guidance has been one that I've been able to come back repeatedly at a later stage and think, now, I was thinking of using, for instance, duloxetine. What's the evidence of that? And just being able to flick through the guidance, it's been quite helpful.
Great. And also just to note in the resources on the module, you mentioned some of the number needed to treat, number needed to harm, and we've got a link to a website with that in the EKU module.
Yep. And we've also got links to sort of patient self-management programs and links to the other non-pharmacological therapies.
Great. Thanks very much, Michael, for your time today.
Thanks, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
You are listening to Essential Knowledge Updates, or EKU, podcasts from the Royal College of General Practitioners.